Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I am really happy today to interview a man, Doug Levy, who recently did a terrific presentation at the Vashon Heritage Museum. He's been part of the Speakers Bureau run by Humanities Washington, and it brings great speakers out to local communities, and it brought Doug to the island. And just in case any of you missed it and will be interested, especially after this interview, Doug is coming back on Tuesday, May 19th to the library, so you'll have another opportunity to hear him. But today, I want to plunge in and ask him some questions myself. Doug is a retired sports writer, reporter, lobbyist, and business owner, and a lifelong sports buff and a huge fan of the Olympic Games. He owned and operated a lobbying and government affairs consulting business for 25 years and worked as a sports reporter, sports columnist, and news reporter for the Tri-City Herald newspaper in Southeast Washington, and as a news and political reporter for the Columbian in Vancouver, Washington, through much of the 80s. But in addition, he has skydived, run two marathons, climbed a mountain, paraglided, bungee jumped, and once testified at a murder trial, which is not exactly a sporting event, but certainly is colorful. So thank you so much. And most importantly, you are the author of the new book, Hero Redefined, a book about Olympians, Olympic athletes, which has come out just in time for our recent Italian Olympics, which I'm sure you spent a lot of hours in front of the TV watching, you know. What interested you to, you know, writing a book is a big deal. How did that become part of your calling after you retired from your firm?
Well, first, thanks for having me. It's a delight to be able to talk about the book. And I have to say that the Vashon Heritage Museum turnout for my presentation, of all the ones I've done so far, that's been the largest turnout. So that's a really nice check mark for Vashon Island. To your question, I think there were two things that drove me to write this book. And I've always considered myself at my central core to be a writer. And I had always thought in my mind that I would try and write a book. And after, you know, I had been down the road away in my career or careers, and my mom was passing away in 2015, I made a promise to my mom that I was going to write a book.
How beautiful. And,
and when you make a promise to your mom, you know, you better keep it. It's, I've always thought so.
Yeah, it's sacred.
So I wanted to do it. And I had two things tugging at me for this particular subject matter. One is I love the Olympics. And I love that when it's done right, as it was in Milan Cortina, we have athletes from all over the world gathering in one place for noble reasons. We can't often say that. You know, the old Washington State University basketball coach George Raveling once said, it's the only time you get to represent your country and not have to carry a gun. And I love that quote. I used it in the introduction of my book. And it's so true because these athletes are there to do their very best. They take great pride in representing their country and they're going to give it their all, but nothing is guaranteed to them. And we, of course, found out all about that once again with Milan Cortina. So the Olympic movement and all it represents, you know, in the best of times was a draw for me. And then I've long been someone interested in not only heroism, but what I would call either quiet or unsung heroism. And both in society, but also in the Olympics, it's always nagged at me that we in the United States get very fixated on the medal stand. We love our winners, we love our repeat winners, and a lot of that is just fine. I mean, if you don't love Michael Phelps as a swimmer or Simone Biles as a gymnast, or we just saw Alyssa Liu and Jordan Stoltz and some of these wonderful athletes at Milan Cortina. If you don't have a reverence for them and what they can do, you probably have a bit of a screw loose. However, there's another part of this, and it's that if you peel back the layer a little bit, you can find heroism in so many other places. Just to give one example, there was an aerial performer named Ollie Martin, and he finished fourth in one of his events. And you say to yourself, "Oh, fourth, he was just off the medal stand." Well, he did that with a broken arm,
Oh
and
my
he
gosh.
competed with a broken arm, and he finished fourth. So that really tells you something about the fiber inside Ollie Martin to do what he did.
And what I really liked about your book is, again, as you just said, we usually focus on the winners, and we have this mythology. Wasn't it Vince Lombardi who said winning isn't, what was his quote? Winning is the only thing. It
Yeah,
ended
it's not
up,
everything, it's the only thing.
it's the only thing. And I think that's kind of an attitude that people have. But you deliberately chose to go after people who maybe didn't make it to the top of the peak, but they showed such courage, such moral fiber, such generosity of spirit, and such inner strength that, in a sense, they were at least as much winners as the winners. Which isn't to pull down against anybody who's won the, been on the stand and took one of the first three places. But I love the fact that you expanded, really, in a sense, what it is to win. How,
And I really wanted to, Sally, I really wanted to push people on the definition of heroism too. That was really the other theme that I tried to draw out in the book, and that is we have this picture in our mind. It's the firefighter entering the burning building, right? It's the doctor and nurses performing the life-saving surgery. That's unquestionably heroic, but then you have all these other things. And in the book, I use the example of the COVID-19 pandemic because it was such an instructive thing for us in so many ways as a time of huge crisis. Of course, you've got, the doctors and those who came up with the vaccine. That's heroic stuff. What about the school systems? They instantly, overnight, they transferred from in-person to online learning. Now, we had our challenges, but they kept it going. And you have truck drivers who were delivering stuff to stores so that all of us could go to the QFC in the Safeway and be able to continue to eat and drink and do what we needed to do during the pandemic while we sheltered in place in many cases. So all of these things, it's a whole tapestry of heroism, and some of it's very obvious and very visible, but some of it is a couple layers beneath the surface. And we have to understand that it's still there, even though you don't see it as the headliner, if you will.
I want to talk about a couple of stories that really illustrated that. Can you tell me what heroism is for you?
I think I've told people, and I really feel like this is true of the athletes in my book. I think the truest heroes are the ones who don't think they are, and they don't want to be thought of as heroes. They just want to be thought of as someone who did the right thing at the right time, under the right circumstances, right? During my talks, I've referenced that horrific shooting that just happened at the tail end of 2025 on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. And you had a gunman literally firing dozens of rounds at people, and such a horrible tragedy. You had the gentleman that intervened and took the gun away and took this guy down. Now, that's heroism, and it's unquestionable. But you also had a woman who there was a couple, and they had two young kids, and they had found one of them, but they couldn't find their little girl. You had a woman who found that little girl and covered her up so that she would not get hit with any of the bullets. She herself, the woman who covered up, was hit with some stray bullets. She survived. We'll never know her name. But at that very time, because she did the right thing in a time of major crisis, that family will have their little girl and they'll see her grow up.
Yeah,
And sorry, I'm getting a little choked up here, but it doesn't
no,
get any better than that,
I
right?
get that. I do choke up. I choked up on some of your stories, and the idea that somebody could stop his own performance in a sailing race to rescue someone in the water and not want a lot of publicity around it, not want to, he was, it sounded from what you were saying like he was just doing what you do,
Yeah. So you're talking about Lawrence Lemieux, and he was a Canadian sailor. And what makes that story all the better in my mind is that Lawrence Lemieux grew up with an uber passion for sailing. He came from the province of Alberta, not really, in Canada. The provinces that are really the sailing capitals are Ontario on the east coast and British Columbia on the west coast. So he had to work extra hard. He had this O'Connell-line van. He drove to competitions all over North America, went through four of them, drove tens of thousands of miles, took odd jobs so he could make enough money to keep competing in sailing competitions. And ultimately, he gets to an Olympics, does okay. But then 1988 in Seoul, South Korea, he thinks that's my time. And what you're referring to, Sally, he was in the second of about seven races and he was doing very well. He was leading the race and then he missed a marker, so he was in second place. But that was going to be an important race for the series, and he was going to put himself in prime position to medal, if not even contend for a gold medal. But then he saw a head bobbing in the water adjacent to the course. And the credo with sailing is you're taught when you see something, you do something. When people need help, you stop and help them. That's easier said than done in an Olympic competition where everybody has put a lifetime of training and effort into being there, and they want to do their very best and they want to win. And Lawrence Lemieux still managed to live by that credo at a time when he could have easily just said, "Hey, it's not my deal. I'm going to continue my race." But he couldn't unsee what he had seen.
Yeah, and bravo for him. And also, when you think of the real medals that you live with for the rest of your life, had he won the gold and lost the man, what prize would that have been? So he got to carry something. Did you, when you started to write the book, have any sense of how timely your book would be? Both because we're coming into an Olympics, but also because this whole question of heroism and not always putting yourself first, it feels very vital today because we see such examples of blatant narcissism that is only out for number one. And it's almost like you want to rekindle something in our own moral fiber that is implicit in your book. Like the goodness of people who will go the extra mile or give themselves fully to their work, not just for their ego, but for something else. Did you have any sense how maybe hungry we would be for examples like that?
Yeah, I have to say on the timing, there's a part of me that would have loved to see this book come out just a month before the Paris Olympics in 2024, right?
Right.
I started it in the spring of 2023, and it became about a 2 year odyssey from starting the work and the interviewing and the writing and getting to publication. So, in a sense, I suppose it still remained good timing because you know, I knew that the Milan Cortina Winter Games are coming up. And then in 2 years, you know, we've got our first Olympic Games on American soil. And in a couple of decades, we're going to have the Summer Games in Los Angeles in 2028. So in that sense, it was good timing. But on the other part of your question, I did want to tell an uplifting story because we have a very, I feel like we have a very toxic world and certainly a very toxic United States of America, where it's so easy to dive into the division, if you will, and take sides and, you know, over computer keyboards compete to see who can have the most viral or controversial post. And we forget that I think there are so many times in our country, I think times of crises tend to really help them rise up. There's so many times in our country we find out how alike we really are and how all of us just wants the best. We want our kids to grow up healthy and be successful. We want our neighbors to be in a good place. We want, you know, to stay healthy. You know, we want the planet to be in a better place when we're gone than when we found it, all of those things. I honestly believe that's where 99.99% of us are. And so, you know, I wanted to tell a story that was positive and upbeat and remind us that there's a lot of goodness and heroism everywhere you look.
I'm so glad you did that. Was there one, I mean, you have a whole array of stories, and I liked how you ranged from people who had faced great physical and health difficulties, and then stories about people who were working back behind the scenes, just trying to have a competition in their native Puerto Rico or in Sarajevo and places like that. There were, and then those who did a good deed for others. So it wasn't about overcoming a physical hardship. It was about a sort of moral hardship. Was there a story that particularly moved you?
Oh, you're getting to the which kid do you love the most question, which I've gotten
It's
a few
totally,
times.
but as an author, it also gives you an opportunity to pick one out of the hat and just tell me. I'm speaking today with author Doug Levy about his book Hero Redefined: Profiles of Olympic Athletes Under the Radar. Doug spoke recently at the Vashon Heritage Museum and will be returning on May 19th to the Vashon Public Library.
Well, my consistent answer, I'll give you two answers here. I really love them all. I'm so grateful to all these athletes who allowed me to tell their stories. But what I will tell you is that there were two athletes who really drove the idea for this story, and they're in chapters one and two. I'll take them in reverse order. Chapter two is about an Olympic women's marathoner named Gabrielle Anderson-Shias. And she was in the very first Olympic women's marathon in 1984, which I tell people sounds silly. It's crazy that it took us until 1984 to understand that women were perfectly capable of running 26.2 miles and running it very well. But even into the 1970s, we had the dynamics of, you know, prestigious events like the Boston Marathon turning away women and saying that they weren't physiologically capable of running that distance. So, unfortunate, we got over that hump in 1984. But what was so cool to me about Gabrielle Anderson, she is a fantastic athlete, came to running late in life. Ran for her native Switzerland, even though she's now lived much of her life in Sun Valley, in the Olympics at age 39. So, one of the older runners in that field, had run a 2:33 marathon, which for your listeners, that's a time that most of us in humanity are never going to touch. It wasn't going to be a medal winning time, but Gabrielle was pretty confident she'd be in the top 10 or 15. Well, That 1984 Olympics, as 2028 will be, it was in Los Angeles. And running in Los Angeles in August under the best of circumstances is really tough. It's going to be hot. It's going to be smoggy. On that particular day in August 1984 for Gabrielle and the other runners, it was also unusually humid. There was a 95% humidity in the air. That's more like what we get in places like New Orleans or Florida. And for that first marathon, and this is for both the men and the women, only five water stations, which again sounds like lunacy. Today we run a 10K, which is 6.2 miles. We can probably expect to see five water stations for that. So all of these things conspired. Gabrielle started very well. But then she started to really feel the effects of the heat. And for reasons even she can't explain, she missed the last of those water stations. So now this extreme heat, humidity, smogginess, running some of the race on blacktop, combines with a major dehydration. And if any of your listeners were to Google Gabrielle Anderson Shias from the 1984 Olympics and look at the video, you'd recognize it. You'd kind of remember it had you watched those games. And, there were some real doubts as to whether she was going to live through that marathon, let alone finish it. But there's a rule in the Olympics that you cannot get medical attention during a race or you will be disqualified. So she waves off the doctors. They did see that she was perspiring. So it occurred to them that she had enough faculties that she wasn't going to just keel over and die. But she was lurching from side to side. She was in a world of hurt. And she wasn't going to win that marathon and she wasn't going to medal. And there had already been some 15 runners that dropped out. So, I think for 99.99% of us, we would have said, I did the best I could. I'm physically in an awful place. I'm not going to finish, and I'm okay with that and step off the course. That's not what Gabrielle did. She somehow, even though it took her 5 minutes and 44 seconds when she entered the Olympic Stadium to finish, she somehow finished that whole marathon. And she didn't do it for the riches. She didn't do it for the medal. She was 37th out of 44 runners that finished. But what she did do, I think, is set a tremendous example for everyone else that, this will to finish and to persevere when things get their toughest. I think she gave young girls watching that first marathon a tremendous lesson in overcoming adversity. And we'll never be able to quantify this, right? But how many women are out there running today who saw those women from 1984 do all these gutsy things as Gabrielle did and say, I want to do that too. So that was one. And the chapter one was about a gentleman named Manteo Mitchell. Now, he was one of the couple chapters of athletes who did win a medal, but I didn't write about he or the other one because of their medal. Manteo got a silver medal in the 4x400 meter relay in London in the 2012 Summer Games. But what happened to him is that he had the honor of leading off our 4 400 meter runners in that relay semifinal. And the first 200 meters was fantastic. He's off like a shot. He's doing well. He's jockeying for first or second. But then he hears an audible snap.
Yeah, I remember that.
And halfway through a 400 meter race, some of us, encounter these tough times and we need to think about what we're going to do next. His thinking time was this. He had to decide what he was going to do. And he looks up at the jumbotron. He's got the next guy motioning. Come on. So I happen to think that in some of these elite athletes, there's something in the DNA which gives them a will to compete that some of us just don't have. Some of us weekend sports warriors, I'll call us. And Manti Mitchell somehow managed to finish that race on a broken left fibula. I talked to the USA track and field team doctor who happens to be a Washington State native, Dr. Bob Adams. He'd never seen anything like that. And so Manteo did something that I think was just unquestionably heroic for his team, for his teammates. And he didn't really tell anyone afterward what had happened. That wasn't why he did it. So again, a guy who says to you, I don't think what I did was heroic. I just did what I did. He's not doing this. He's not patting himself on the back, but you look and you say, man, this guy did a hell of a job for his teammates, and he's one of the major reasons why the United States went from the semifinal to the final and got the silver medal it did. But he did it because he thought it was the right thing to do for his teammates at the time.
Did you have an opportunity to talk to these people either on Zoom or in person, or are some of them already gone, or did you?
Almost all of them, and thank goodness for the technology of Zoom, because that's how I did most of my interviews. There was a Tanzanian marathoner who's a chapter of the book who my wife and I happened to be going there for a series of safaris, and the touring company we worked with somehow did this needle in a haystack thing and was able to find his daughter. So I did an interview with this marathoner, John Stephen Aquari, in Tanzania, which was pretty great. And there was one athlete in the book in chapter 11. You can read about Peter Norman, who was an Australian sprinter in the 1968 Summer Games. And I wish I would have had the opportunity to talk to Peter Norman. He died of a heart attack in 2006, but his story is an incredibly interesting one, and one that I don't think very many Americans at all were aware of.
I'm speaking today with author Doug Levy about his book Hero Redefined: Profiles of Olympic Athletes Under the Radar. One of the things I'm not sometimes this is going to say more about me than anything, but sometimes it's difficult for me to watch these extremely competitive sports because I know how much everybody has put into just qualifying for the games. And for everybody who wins, there's going to be 10, or more who's in a sense are having their hearts break because they didn't. And I really hate it when the newscasters come out and say, how did it feel to lose the race that you were counting on? It just makes me cringe. But I do wonder how people deal with the level of regret, if they have it. I mean, yes, you can say you made it, you're a star, you gave it everything, you couldn't have done more. But that's different than the inner voice that can still harbor an I wish. So how did people, if they had to, how did they cope with that? And is there anything that you can pull out of that to tell us about how one deals with massive disappointment while continuing on?
Yeah, there's a flood of thoughts here, and let me try and get to all of them because it's a great question. First of all, and I tell people this, being in the Olympic Games in and of itself is a tremendous feat. We need to remember that because you can fit on a tiny pinhead all the athletes who get to an Olympic Games and can call themselves Olympians. So that's one thing we tend to forget, and I regret that our national media tends to forget it more quickly than most. The second thing is that the Olympics can often be a crapshoot. You don't know what your health is going to be in that particular 2-week period of time. You don't know what the weather's going to be. You don't know what the conditions will be. You don't know if one of your competitors is going to run the race or skate the skate of his or her life. There's a middle and long distance runner from the state of Oregon named Mary Decker Slaney, who, if I went into a bar with one of your listeners for a beer and we started talking about the best middle and long distance runners ever for females, I think I'd put Mary Decker Slaney's name on the table. She set or tied 17 different world records during her career, but she never won a medal. So is she not one of the greatest middle and long distance runners ever because she didn't medal at the Olympic Games? I would say no. I mean, in no other profession can I think of a situation where someone says, you will be judged almost exclusively by what you do in a 2-week period of time. Nobody says that to the doctor. Nobody says that to the radio host. I'm going to judge you by your radio shows between August 8th and 22nd in 2016.
And
And
sometimes
yet, that's what we do.
a 10-minute period of time, you know. So you're there for 2 weeks, but that 10 minutes on the course is the thing that will determine.
That's the thing.
So,
Yeah. And
but how did they deal with it? How did they
yeah,
cope with the
so
regret?
let's get to that. I think for many of these athletes, with time comes perspective and the ability to look back maybe with a clearer head than when you went through it. So a very vivid example I have is he's chapter 3 of the book, and his name is David Moorcroft. He's a distance runner from Great Britain, and he ran the 5,000. And in his day, he was every bit as good as Sebastian Coe, who your track and field listeners will say, oh, there's a big name, or Steve Cram or Steve Ovett from the golden age of running in Great Britain. Those are huge names. David Moorcroft was right there with them. And in 1982, he steps on a track in Oslo, Norway to run a 5,000 in a great field. Not only does he set a world record, but he obliterates a world record. So I'm a track and field geek, but for any of the other track and field geeks who might be listening to it, David Moorcroft took 14 seconds off the 5,000 meter world record that day in 1982. Had the Olympics been held in 1982 when he was really healthy and at the top of his game, we're talking about him in reverential tones. But in 1984, when the Olympics were held again in Los Angeles, David Moorcroft was dealing with a variety of very painful injuries, not the least of which was a pelvic injury. He ran the 5,000. He thought about dropping out, but he said to himself, every time I've run a race, I've finished a race, and I intend to do that again. But he came in last. And for the longest time, David Moorcroft didn't want to talk about Los Angeles. But then, again, time brings perspective. Perspective gives you the ability to step back a pace or two and say, yeah, in his case, he was in multiple Olympic Games. He'll be able to call himself a world record holder for the rest of his life. He went on to a great broadcasting career. He's had a great marriage. And maybe most importantly of all, he started something called the Coventry Foundation in the area where he lived in Great Britain, that's done all kinds of great things, raising funds and providing services to underprivileged kids. And so the legacy that David Moorcroft has built and led over a lifetime, I think equals or even more than offsets the medals that he didn't get. And so, to your question, was there just supreme disappointment for David Moorcroft? There was a Canadian skier in my book, Brian Stemmel, who wanted a gold medal in the worst way in 1998 and came 80% of the way toward getting it. But they're able to, I think, step back and understand that the disappointment had its time. But they're still Olympians. They still had amazing careers. They can still look at the totality of what they did and realize there were so many more blessings than curses. And that's not easy to do, but that's another one of the things I admired about these athletes. For some of them, you're asking them to recreate a story that was pretty painful to go through for a while.
Yeah. As we aim towards the end of this interview, I'm really curious about how this writing project might have affected you or even changed you. First of all, writing a book like this in 2 years actually is like running a very fast marathon. So congratulations.
Well,
I
thank
know
you.
what's involved. But did it, do you feel changed as a result of being in communication with these stellar heroes that you interviewed?
I do. I've always felt like my mom and my mother-in-law too, they're standard bearers for something I call empathy. I wish we had more empathy in the world. One of them was very good at it. The other one, still alive, is very good at it. And I think writing this book helped me build my reservoir of empathy. And again, I'll go to this Milan Cortina games we just watched. This young man who's all of 21, Ilya Malinin. He's a figure skater.
Yeah.
And Ilya Malinin in the individual competition falls twice in the free skate. And then he misses something else and he winds up in eighth place. Now, again, for perspective, on his worst day in the office, he was eighth best in the world. That's not too shabby. But then to your question, Sally, he had a microphone stuck in his face seconds after he finished. And he handled himself with incredible eloquence and grace. Said he blew it, said he's going to learn from it. And then he also hugged the winning skater, the gentleman from Kazakhstan, who was a very unexpected gold medal winner. And I said to my wife, I love both our boys to death, but I don't know if either of them could have exhibited that kind of grace and sportsmanship that Ilya Malinin just did with the whole world's eyes watching him. So I think to your question, I've learned more than ever before that empathy is an important quality, and we need to retain it when we watch these athletes who do things the rest of us can't do. They're not always going to be the first place winner, but they're doing extraordinary things.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for bringing that to us, to bringing the importance of empathy, but also to broadening our sights on what heroism, especially in an Olympic context, can look like. That it doesn't have to be standing on the platform. It so many ways it can happen behind the scenes, and really, the race is within. And each of the people that you describe won that race.
Very much so. And what I tell your listeners is there's heroes out there all the time, every day, in all these circumstances. Look underneath the headlines, you'll find them. And
Yeah.
it's a great thing.
Or just go and start asking questions of your neighbors, and you'll find those heroes as well. Because I know
That's right.
interviewing people on Vashon, we are full of heroes with fantastic stories, some of which may never be heard, but doesn't make them any less real. So,
Absolutely. And I hope people will read Hero Redefined. You'll find a bunch of heroes there.
yes, Hero Redefined, available on Amazon. And are you going to get it into the Vashon bookshop as well before
I think any of the independent bookstores are able to order it. And then if you Google Hero Redefined Amazon or Barnes and Noble or Goodreads, which works a lot with independent bookstores, you can get it. And you can also go to my website, which is called Author Doug Levy, all one word,
Yes.
dot com.
Yes. And I always give a shout out to a place called bookshop.org, because when you order the book, you
They're
can
great
just,
too.
you say, part of the profit goes to the Vashon Bookshop, whom, and I love the Vashon Bookshop. So anything that we can do to support independent booksellers is
Oh,
great.
I'm a big fan of those. We
Yeah.
need to have them in our central communities.
Totally. And I hope you'll bring, can you bring books when you come on the 17th of May to the Vashon, or the
19th of May.
19th of
Yeah.
May, Tuesday the 19th, the Vashon Library.
I absolutely will bring books, and I had the honor of signing several at the Vashon Heritage Museum, so I pledge to do it again, and I'd love to see a big turnout.
Great, great. Well, thank you so much for spending time with me. I feel inspired, and you've opened my eyes to what sports greatness can really look like. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.